Category E6, Sports Broadcaster of the Year, Ger Gilroy.
Now, on yesterday's programme, we played out an interview that we did with Emma O'Reilly about her new book, which is called Race to Truth, which is about her relationship with Lance Armstrong, David Walsh, the doping culture in cycling, and the sport itself, all up for discussion. It's quite confusing to think that somebody who was as villainous as Lance Armstrong was can be forgiven by somebody he hurt so spectacularly like Emma O'Reilly. Naturally, you'd be a bit suspicious of Lance, a point that I did raise with Emma O'Reilly. Just here's a few bits from that.
Given that he used everybody so horribly along the way to get to the top, at what point do you get comfortable that he's not just using you again?
I have to go on my instinct. My instinct says he's not.
He manages to convince you of that, though, at some point.
I guess I haven't asked him, in a sense. And I guess, too, say, with bringing over the newspapers, that was my choice. And like even, I remember I emailed him, I phoned him, and I texted him to say, you're up to something. What are you up to?
Yeah.
You don't let go of control. And he's gone, nothing. And I did that, and I then still emailed him again, even though when I spoke to him, so I kind of heard him. He had to text me, but he then had to email me it. And I'm still going, now, come on. You know, and so even right to meeting him, that's why I took someone with me to kind of protect my interests. And I still didn't fully trust him. That kind of come probably since our meeting. You know, and it's one thing I even said to Matt, the journalist, he's going, watching, he might. And I said, I'll tell you one thing about Lance. He's told me a few times that he's got no agenda, he just wants to meet me, he's bringing no one. I said, he attacks from the front. You know what's coming. If he's going to go. So I guess in that sense, from my perspective, I'm not clever enough to go with people's agendas. I can take someone if they're coming at me from head first.
Yeah, well, you're a very reliable witness from his perspective. You saying that you now forgive him and trust him, there's about five or six people in the world who, if he gets that from those people, then the rest of the world can go, oh, that's all right, we can get past this now.
Do you think, though, because I think everybody's entitled to their opinion, and just because I say something or I've moved on to
something. You're a very powerful person in this. It goes back to the point of that you made in the interview with David Walsh. You're a hugely important source.
I suppose I can sit there and say, and I wouldn't have thought I was an important source, and that's probably one of the things where David and I miscommunicated.
But now you're a very powerful source for people to go, okay, well, people are beginning to get over what Lance did to them. People like Emma are beginning to forgive him what happened. Yeah. And maybe that is hugely beneficial to him.
Maybe, but it's hugely beneficial to me.
Well, it's
been great for me because I've gone back to being who I used to be, that I'm much lighter and kind of more young at heart, freer.
Yeah.
And also I kind of feel as human beings in a civilised society, it's not part of being mature and being civilised, actually forgiving and forgetting and learning from things.
Betty Andrea was another key witness in all this. She was a strong voice against the biggest doper in the history of sport, despite the great personal toll it had the potential to wreak on her family. And we're very grateful to Betty Andrea for joining us now. Betty, you've listened to Emma O'Reilly's interview on Off the Ball last night. What did you make of it?
I was pretty surprised. I had to rewind when I was listening because I thought, did she really say what I thought she said? So I was pretty stunned, and I thought you did a very good job.
What was it that stunned you?
That she doesn't think she's being used. I mean, if we look at Lance's history, he is a masterful manipulator, and I understand the complete forgiveness aspect of this because right after he called, I went on TV in America, on national TV, and I said, you know what, let's give him a chance. I am a practicing Catholic, and I understand that forgiveness is a tenet of my religion. And so I think it's a learning lesson. This is a learning lesson with so many, in so many aspects. And so I wanted to forgive him. And so for 3 months, I kept in touch with Lance. And I wanted him to meet with Travis and tell him everything. I wanted him to give David Walsh an interview. I wanted to meet with him. And he said, okay, we will meet. For the 3 months that I was played, and I'm very embarrassed to say I was fooled, he kept me at bay. He kept me quiet. He shut me up. I wasn't critical of him. I said, let's give him a chance. I went to Austin, Texas, and at the 11th hour, he refused to meet with me. And I said, that's it. I know he's playing me. Because all along, during these 3 months, you can say you're sorry, but actions speak louder than words. And so when I see that he's still blaming Travis, that he's still going after David Walsh, that he still won't talk about the hospital room because of legal reasons, like he told me, then I know that he really is not contrite. He's doing it to now attempt to rewrite history. And you made an excellent point. If he can get Emma on his side, then people will say, oh my gosh, you know, if one of his fiercest critics forgive him, then why can't Betsy Andreu just shut up and do the same? I tried to tell Emma, he's using you, Emma. He's using you. She knows what he did with me. She knows that he's still blaming Travis, refusing to meet with David. And I never heard back from her. Never heard back from her. And really, and then people, how can I not be angry when I see how he's using her? When I see that he's giving interviews and he's lying and being disingenuous? I didn't read her book, but I've had some people send me excerpts from it. And I got to tell you, it really does get me upset, because when she gives Lance carte blanche to say that I'm nuts and crazy because I sent him an email and she doesn't explain the story behind it, I'm thinking, you are doing exactly what he wants you to do.
Do you want to explain about the email? Just we'll cover that bit in the book. There's a bit where the team are up looking at over the course of the tour, and Lance turns to Emma and says something along the lines of, Betsy's crazy. And I don't know if he actually shows her the email, or but there's a reference to an email that you've written, and then that's the end of that. It's not like, well, you know, there's no context for it.
No, and the thing was that Frankie and Lance got into an argument at Amstel Gold in April, and Lance had threatened Frankie and said that he had the power to make sure he would never ride the Tour de France again, that he had the power to, that he was full of power. And so I wrote Lance back and I said, who in the hell do you think you are threatening Frankie not to ride the Tour? You don't treat people with respect. We don't have to put up with it, and we're not going to put up with your disrespectful attitude. So that's where that came from. But she doesn't put that in context. And so it's just, what, is Lance doing his bidding through Emma now?
We've got two of the stalwarts from the Ireland team in the 2000s facing off to prove once and for all who is the brainiest and broniest of the Saipan survivors. In one corner, we have Ireland's Ironman, from Iceland to Macedonia, from Lithuania to Armenia. If you're an insignificant European country, odds are this man has worn the green jersey in your crappy national stadium. Ireland's third most capped player, and somehow still our only good rapper, Kevin Kilbane.
Love it, elite. You better gain weight. You better hit bulls on the kid, don't play. If there's a problem, yo, I'll solve it. Check out the hook of my DJ.
Taking on Kevin Kilbane tonight, he's a former Ireland captain and the only pundit in Ireland with the balls to tell Eamon Duffy where to stick it. Put your hands together for Kenny Cunningham.
In fact, I think he put a fracture.
I was going to say a ball.
What is the evidence for that? No, there's no evidence.
Oh. Just like there's no evidence that he would have pulled the dressing room together.
The rules are simple. There's three rounds. Each contestant will bring their score to the grueling rapid-fire round. Let's get on with it. We should have won the 2002 World Cup round, which is not multiple choice. Question one for you, Kenny. In Ireland's 2002 World Cup round of 16 game against Spain, we all remember Iker Casillas saving Ian Hart's penalty. Which Ireland player was perfectly placed to score from the rebound, only to put it shockingly wide?
Who said he's in golf now? Yeah?
Honestly. Clearly was you.
You don't remember?
Correct.
The crowd reaction. The crowd reaction.
Correct. Kevin Kilbane is the answer.
Was it on his right foot, clearly, though?
I wasn't on your right foot.
No, I wasn't, actually, no.
You could have told
that
us.
Left foot's lethal.
Yeah.
That left foot's lethal, isn't it?
I know it was, yeah.
Kevin, we do, of course, go on to lose to Spain on penalties. Two Irishmen managed to put the ball past Iker Casillas in that ill-fated penalty shootout. Robbie Keane was one, but who was the other?
Stevie Finnan.
Correct. Round two. The media career of Kevin Kilbane round, which is not multiple choice. Question two for you, Kenny. While you were trapped in Montrose this summer with Richie Sadler and Eamon Dunphy, Kevin Kilbane was in Brazil at the World Cup, where he provided in-depth football analysis for the BBC. He also ingratiated himself with members of the South American Media Corps, including a reporter from Colombia.
How did that come back to haunt you?
Is that haunting me? No.
We had this discussion earlier, Jeff. I won't repeat.
I was going to say, speaking of Colombia, Kenny, what was the score when Brazil knocked Colombia out of the World Cup? That was just a gratuitous excuse to use that picture. What did Brazil beat Colombia by?
2-1.
Correct.
Yeah.
Question two for you, Kevin. Your version of Ice Ice Baby in Gdansk was the standout performance of any Irish footballer at Euro 2012. I think we can all agree. So we have a Vanilla Ice question for you. In the song Ice Ice Baby, Vanilla Ice attends a party where girls were hot wearing less than bikinis and Rockman lovers were driving Lamborghinis. Ice mentions the address of the party. What was it?
Don't pretend you don't know it, Kev. Don't pretend. Come on.
Summer Avenue, anyway.
Yeah. Somebody shouted it there. I thought I heard.
What are you saying?
Sing it.
Beachwood Avenue, is it?
A1A Beachfront.
Beachfront.
Oh. Close enough.
That's everybody disappointed.
It was, yeah. There was stuff that was emotionally upsetting for me and just reliving stuff that's... John, look at the stuff in it there about bereavement and that, George, that we've no patent on bereavement. Like, there's way worse cases. I watched TV3 this morning. I saw a couple there with two terminally ill children and, you know, to just go through you, like, just to watch it, drinking a cup of coffee. And look, at maybe I was lucky to have my dad for 8 years, you know, and some people are not that lucky. And it was just my own experience of it, though, you know, and that's all we could talk about. I suppose it is my bloody book and my name on it. Yeah. So we just wanted to touch on that, I suppose, and the effect maybe it had on me as a young lad and then subsequently my brother's sudden death and the timing of that as well, ironically, the night before the 1998 All-Ireland.
Yeah, I mean, those are two incredibly powerful moments in the book as well. It seeps through the whole book, I have to say, that those are kind of such life-changing moments. But we have a culture in Ireland maybe of not addressing all these things. And I think it's more important that people do stand up and say, we suffer pain. You don't have a patent on it, but it's actually a very universal thing. And that's why the book works, I think.
Yeah, for a while at school, Ger, straight out, like, if the parent or if the teacher unintentionally mentioned your parents... Like I used to suffer in the classroom. I knew I did. I used to get red and embarrassed and hot and sweaty, as the fella says. And because for some reason, you know, I had only one parent. Like, and I still hadn't fully come to grips with that. You know, and then down at the world has changed a huge amount. That's the late '70s. You know, and sure, look, things have changed in the country for much better in lots of ways, and maybe much worse in some other ways. But it was sort of something that affected me, and I wanted to talk about that, and that was it, and that was real, and it was true. Like, what I've noticed over the last few years has been that there's been a massive advance in people admitting to their problems in public and not hiding things behind closed doors when some people knew about things. And I've said it, like, on a couple of pieces of media over the last while, that Brent Pope has been someone I don't know at all. Like, I think I met him once just to shake hands with him. And, like, Brent, you know, out coming about his, you know, he struggled with anxiety and that kind of thing and depression a little bit. And it's been powerful, you know. And the likes of Oisín McConville's story, you know, and things like that. I think that's been fantastic. And, you know, I know the GPA got a bit of stick lately and for going down different routes or whatever. But I think they've been a fantastic outlet for the guys as well that... An awful lot of us, like, I stood up and got a cup there, Ger, in 1995, and I let rip with an old speech there from the bottom of my toes. I felt no nerves at all the same day. I don't know why. It was like an out-of-body experience the whole day. I don't know why. Maybe it was the breakthrough in Munster, which I was desperately nervous for, and I felt the pressure was off us. But, like, about 3 weeks later, I was at a dinner dance in front of 250 people, and I was the guest speaker. And I tell you, I nearly went to pieces. Because it hit me all of a sudden that these people were expecting this great speech now or some sort of a words of wisdom or an Al Pacino effort. And, like, no one trained me. No one gave me any bit of advice about that. And I think the GPA is a fantastic facility that way for the players of the country now that they can, if they have a problem, they can go to people and there's experts there that can help them with that.
Yeah, I think too as well, it is actually quite a powerful thing to hear people like you who we all have seen that amazing speech admit that 2 or 3 weeks later you're kind of going, oh Jesus, I have to replicate this now.
Absolutely, and that's gone on for years. I tell you, this 20 years on nearly, that's the same feeling. Sometimes you can go up on stage maybe in front of 150 insurance delegates and nail it. And you could be going into a TY year class talking about dedication to sport or whatever and go to pieces. Yeah. You know, and that's the reality of it. And I think that's why sometimes the GAA fell down a bit on that. Like they just let people off. And some people discovered afterwards, you know, that other things went wrong in life as a result. And I was very conscious of that, you know, we weren't really helped in any way that way.
It does feel like there is a potential for the GAA to become a real agent for change and for that. And I actually think that's the best thing the GPA are doing, is making sure that all the intercounty players are kind of being force-fed education and being kind of, yeah, it's being drummed into them, go and get your education, use your profile to get your career going and don't put that on hold.
Absolutely. And like down to every level with coaching and down along to that, you know, that people are way more tolerant now, like that it shouldn't be just all about winning the under 15 championship or the minor championship. Like I was selector with Tom Howard, my buddy, for the last two seasons with the Clarecastle Minors, not this season now, but 2012 and 2013. Obviously made a show of myself in this first minor final, went in to a schmozzle I'd no right to go into and got an 8-week suspension, which was a grand thing compared to the publicity we got, which was hard to deal with as well when you've three kids at home. But one of the things was we would have held up our hands and got the players around us 2 or 3 weeks later and said, we were absolutely so sorry for our conduct on the day. And if they stuck with us, we'd promise to give absolutely everything to be the perfect management the following year. We weren't, but we won the following year's minor championship. And we did try and address some of our faults, and we had a couple of meetings about that. And I think we were more tolerant of the players the following year as well, because we said to ourselves, they're 17, 18, 16 here. They're going through all sorts of things in life. And yeah, can we help them a bit here? If a fella's missing training for a couple of nights, is there a reason? Is it just not that he's the lazy so-and-so?
Yeah.
Maybe there's a reason he's not getting up on a Saturday morning and I want him training at 7:30. Do you know that he might have something going on here that we don't understand?
The relationship as well with Alex Ferguson is quite funny in parts where you seem happy enough to take him on about his tactics after a mistake in the Bayern Munich game in 2010, for example. Mm. Was it intentional, the fact that he heard you're giving out about the substitutions?
Yeah, I don't think it was hard not to see it, because I had my arms waving around on the pitch and I was screaming in the tunnel, like going crazy, like swearing, effing and blinding. And
yeah. Gary Neville just trying to calm
you
down.
Just out of frustration, really, and that's just the way I was. I hated losing. I've always hated losing, and then emotions take over, and you can't control yourself. Come in the changing room, and the manager was just waiting for me. I could see he must have heard it, and the door shut, and he just went bananas. And we had like a little bit of a back and forth from me arguing. I remember Gary Neville tapping me and saying, "Rio, just can't leave it. You're not going to win the argument with him. You won't." And I was sitting there thinking, "Well, I know you think what I'm thinking. Say it as well." But that's just the way. Well, I mean, Gary Neville knew the manager and he knew him well, and he didn't really want to get on
the best side part about of that is that you go home and have a sleepless night and you're all ready to come in the next day and go, "Look, you know, I should have waited."
Apologise.
And he just goes at you again.
And he erupted like a volcano again and battered me again. But that was the way he was.
He forgives you for it, though. In the way that, like, from the outside, we just assume, you know, someone.
Yeah, but that's a sign of a professional, a real professional, that he doesn't hold grudges like that. He didn't agree with me when I kind of aired my views on things, and I think he realised that it wasn't an ego thing and it wasn't an image thing for me. It was purely about winning. I wanted to win. He wanted to win, and I'm not shouting and shouting the odds based on trying to up my reputation or anything. This is about, I want to win games. And so I think after a while he realised that.
I think the most important thing in the book as well, that comes part of that Ferguson thing where he's very nice to your mum after the Anton case, it's you being somebody who's actually willing to tell everything that happened to you and express your viewpoint from somebody who was such an important footballer for Manchester United and England for such a long period of time about the issue of racism in the game and how we need to have conversations about this, intelligent, articulate, open conversations.
Yeah, I think people try and pretend, and I got caught up in that football is going to be a great way to stop racism and stuff. And before you can even attack racism, you've got to start in society. I think, as I said, I got caught up in our football's a great tool to do it and we'll stop racism like this. No, it's the other way around. You've got to go into classrooms, you've got to go in people's homes and educate people, articulate people on racism. And I'm from a mixed background, so I see a lot of it from different sides. I've got a lot of white family and a lot of black family. So I've seen a lot of different types of racism throughout my life, and to be able to have a voice and have a platform to speak now and not use it would have been criminal in my eyes. For
you're going to keep doing it though, because
and I think it'll be. I've got kids. I don't want them coming into situations like this and feeling they've got to kind of keep their head down in certain situations or feel isolated in certain situations. I want them to be able to walk around at all times and see no colour like the way I do. News Talk 106 to 108.